introduction that we're definitely doing. I've just been told off mic, oh, we've got to do the intro. You're getting bad at doing intros. So here we are. It's the intro.
It's good. It's as smooth as I'd hoped.
Yes. Yeah.
So go on then.
Welcome to The Art Soul. This is the podcast where we take apart pieces of art and try to put them back together a little bit better. That's normally your line.
Yep.
Hello, I'm Bea Roberts. I'm an award-winning playwright and script doctor. And with me, as always, is some drunk.
Hi, I'm Luke Haynes. I'm a real smart ass.
Yes.
And we should mention as well, we forgot last week to say in our interview with the vampire, we still have Disco the podcast puppy.
Disco is still here. She's asleep by the fire.
I think because she's, when we first started the podcast, she was literally a puppy. She's now three and a bit. So
we're kind of sick of her, to be honest.
I was going to say she's a lot more sedate, so have to go, oh, that noise you can hear in the background.
Yes, that's true. Yeah.
Although the noise you can hear in the background is a roaring fire because it's cold as fuck out here.
It's fucking Baltic at the moment, when we're recording this.
But we're about to take a journey to a hot destination. Where are we going this week, Luke Haynes?
Yes, we did it. We finally did it. God damn you. God damn you all to hell. We finally watched Avatar 2. We've watched Avatar The Way of Water. You're welcome. Don't ever talk to me about suffering for art again.
I watched it too.
Yeah, I know. You were on your phone for some of it.
I was on my phone for a lot of it because fuck me, is this film boring?
Oh, it's the sequel nobody wanted to the film nobody remembers.
But what I'm interested in doing is trying to unpack this dramaturgically, look at what he's trying to do, why it doesn't work. We're going to get technical, not just bitch about James Cameron.
I feel like this is a back to basics episode where we have to look at what doesn't work and why, and that was my thought on
Great.
So normally I do a plot synopsis. I'm going to kind of skim it because, again,
thank God.
Yeah, because nobody cares. And I'm sure you, the listener, will agree. You don't give a shit about this. Neither did we, neither did anybody else, right?
I mean, also, it basically, the plot, I could summarise the plot as Avatar 1, almost the exact same plot, but more bloated and more repetitive.
Yeah. But we'll get through it quickly. So Jake Sully, the main guy from the first movie, and his wife, played by Zoe Saldana, they got married at the end of the first film and now have some kids. They're just permanently blue cat people now. There's no, they're just blue cat monsters. The kids are they've adopted the virgin child of Sigourney Weaver's character. So at the end of the last movie, Sigourney Weaver was had her brain zapped into a blue cat person as well. But she's apparently been comatose ever since. Nobody knows why. But somehow she became pregnant magically and has given birth to a magical blue cat monster.
Yeah, because she must have done it with the tree god.
Yeah, the child is also played by Sigourney Weaver for some reason, confusingly.
Yeah.
They've adopted... Ooh. Sorry.
Put the fire guard up before we set the dog on fire.
That's just the fire exploding. We'll carry on as normal. One of their other children, Colonel Quaritch, the bad guy from the previous movie, played by Stephen Lang, apparently fathered a child, but when the humans left, children under a certain age can't be transported through hyperspace, so the baby had to stay. So he's been raised with the blue cat kids as sort of space Mowgli, effectively.
Oh, blonde dreadlocks boy.
Yeah, blonde dreadlock boy. He's a human boy, he's space Mowgli. And then their other two biological kids are interchangeable, one of whom thinks he's African, for reasons that are clear. It's really fucking weird, right? And initially, I thought, well, maybe everybody's in CGI. Nobody's, really on screen. So maybe they just hired an African actor because they liked him for the part. I checked that both kids are played by white actors. Right?
So one of them's doing an odd South African
accent. One of them is just doing that sort of... He's doing that...
I mean, there are white South Africans, so...
Yeah, but neither
strange
of his,
choice.
Neither of his parents sound like that. And he's doing that thing that, actors do when they're doing a quote-unquote African accent where they're all doing this kind of cod Nigerian thing where it's like the other accents are probably available. It's a continent, but they all do the same one.
No one else on Pandora talks like that.
No.
So where he's got... Because, normally your voice comes from where you grew up, right?
Yeah.
Which is why I don't think children should be raised in Birmingham.
Yeah.
But I'm so sorry.
We'll get letters.
No one else talks like that.
No.
So he's not got that... He's not picked up that voice at school.
Well, I thought, I thought maybe it was a Nigerian actor and that, James Cameron, notoriously hard taskmaster of a director, I thought even James Cameron... in the year 2023, would not have the balls as an old white man to tell an African actor to be less African, right? So maybe they just had to live with it. But no. I mean, Joss Whedon did that, and that's why he doesn't get to make movies anymore, right?
Yeah.
But no, it's a white guy putting on this weird African accent. And
one of a series of strange choices.
Yeah.
A lot of strange racial choices in Avatar as well.
Yeah, and I get that it sort of doesn't matter because they're all blue cat monsters, so fine. But it still does matter, right? Because, if you turned up on set... in blackface and going, well, nobody can see it because I'm a, you go, no, that's still not okay. So why is this white actor doing this?
It doesn't make, yeah, I mean, it doesn't make sense on that level, on kind of an interpersonal outside of the movie level, but yeah. It just doesn't make sense in the story. There's absolutely no reason for him to have this voice. And in a world that is quite baffling and lacks cohesion, this is just an unhelpful element to just chuck in.
Anyway, he's one of the two teenage sons. There's an older one and a younger one. I cannot tell them apart because they're both blue cat monsters and they're very
and
thinly
the personalities drawn. Personalities.
Yeah, what the younger one son. Is the younger one is slightly more rebellious, and the older one's job is to keep the younger one in line, which he's bad at. And that's the anyway, the Sky People return, which is we've got this voiceover from Jake Sully, who now refers to humans as the Sky People, which is really wanky because he used to be a human, right?
I know, it's like he's gone on his gap year.
Yes, and you said that he's got a very gap year energy. Oh yeah, we call them Sky People.
People don't even know.
Yes, when I'm on my gap year.
When I was on my gap year.
Yes, he's got that energy in spades. So he says the Sky People return rather than just calling them humans, which is like anyway. Once again, led by Colonel Quaritch Stephen Lang, who was killed at the end of the first film, but has now himself been turned into a blue cat monster, so he can like compete on an even footing. And they are after Sully in particular, because he is now the resistance leader, he's the figurehead, so they're going to go after him and try to break the resistance by taking him out.
Because even though he's not a native Na'vi person, he is the most important special Na'vi person.
We'll get to it, yes. So they kidnap the kids, and specifically they kidnap Space Mowgli. Sully then decides that like he is posing a threat to the tribe, so they're going to go and move in with their auntie and uncle in Bel Air. No, sorry, the other thing. They're going to go and live at the coast with the water cat people who live on an island.
Yes.
So they're basically, like all franchises that run out of ideas, they're going to do a holiday episode, right? Yeah. The two sons and the other kids don't get on with the new neighbours. The kids get in a fight with the water cat kids, and the water cat kids pretend to want to bury the hatchet by inviting the rebellious son on a trip on their Loch Ness monsters. So in the first film, everyone has to learn, if you're a forest cat person, you have to learn how to ride a sky monster.
Yeah.
Now the water cat people all have pet Loch Ness monsters that they have to learn
like,
to ride.
It's almost exactly the same. It's just slightly more aquatic here.
Yeah, exactly. We have another learning to ride a monster. Anyway.
And if you're a fan of insensitive racial accents, Kate Winslet.
Kate Winslet is here as the new tribal... The water cat people's tribal chief's wife, who is pregnant and doing an accent that she probably
she's
shouldn't
doing
be.
Doing a kind of, I don't know, somewhere in the North African Arabic region
which
accent.
Which is weird because they are coded as very Pacific Rim. They're very like Maori Polynesian.
Yes.
They've all got that intricate tattoo thing going on that a lot of Pacific Rim tribes have. Yeah. But Kate Winslet didn't want to be a Kiwi, I don't know.
Ironically,
Sam Worthington, who plays Sully, is a Kiwi, but he's playing American. It's a fucking mess in all directions. Anyway, the water cat kids pretend to want to bury the hatchet with the younger son and invite him out for a trip on their Loch Ness monsters, but then they ditch him at sea, where he's lost at sea and he's attacked by a space shark and then rescued by a space whale.
Yep.
My next note just says, the whale can talk, fuck you.
I forgot about this bit.
Yeah, you went for a pee during this bit, and I very nearly, despite this movie being far too long, I nearly paused and rewound it so you could see it.
You did pause and rewound it. Yeah, you did. You made me watch it.
I was drinking. And I will not apologise for that. There's a bit where he starts talking to his new space whale friend and says, like, oh, how come... The space whales are travelling pods like whales, but this is a lone one. This is a rogue space whale. And he's like, oh, how come you're an outcast? And the subtitles come up, it's too painful to talk about. And it is the stupidest fucking thing I've
Luke was
ever
so excited,
seen.
He ran up to the bathroom door and shouted through
you it. You've got to come and see this shit. This is so dumb. Yeah. I just got a note here. This takes itself far too seriously for talking space whale to be any fun. I can see talking space whale being a fun concept, not in this po-faced bullshit.
I forgot that, like, just as if Avatar wasn't impossible to watch enough, it's also got subtitles, and the subtitles are never in the same place on the screen, and they are in a strange font that is lightly coloured, so they are also difficult to read just from a purely technical point of view.
Yeah. Meanwhile, back at the kidnapping, having gained the trust of his son, Space Mowgli, Colonel Quaritch now begins a campaign of terror against the Sea Cat people, because Space Mowgli said, oh, maybe they've gone to live with the Sea Peoples. So Colonel Quaritch and his team of blue cat people mercenaries start burning down villages trying to force Sully out of hiding. This horrifies Space Mowgli, his son. They decide to team up with human whalers of the moon, of Pandora, to antagonize the Watercat people who view the whales as their extended family. So the whaling people, the whalers on the moon of Pandora, I'm going to keep doing this joke, I mean, it's for the nerds out there. There are human whalers on the moon of Pandora because the space whale brain contains a valuable goop that can stop human aging. That's the thing.
Yeah. Now, I don't know if you remember in Avatar 1.
That's my next note. Wither unobtainium. They were mining the planet Pandora for unobtainium, which you rightly found fucking ridiculous.
I still love it.
Yeah, and we're completely jettisoned that now.
I know, but what I was going to say is, in Avatar 1, the sky people, which we used to call humans, they were cutting down the trees, but the trees were sacred to the Na'vi because they contained, like, spiritual goodness.
Yeah.
And in this movie, they're going after the whales, and the whales are sacred to the Na'vi
because they
contain kind of spiritual... Well,
they're like their family. It's yeah.
Yep. Like the special tree Scorny Weaver had sex with.
Yeah. Sexy tree. Anyway, with the sea cat way of life under threat, Sully realizes that he must face Colonel Quaritch once again. This leads to a big sea battle where the older son is tragically killed. Sigourney Weaver's Jesus child learns that she has the power to control nature.
Oh, didn't call that within the first fucking 3 seconds.
Yeah. And Sully and his wife defeat the evil humans and leave Quaritch for dead. He is rescued by his son, Space Mowgli, who then nevertheless disowns him. All of this takes 3.5 fucking hours. And the ending beat is Sully deciding that he can't run from his problems and he's going to have to fight again. He already decided this, like, in the last movie, once in this movie. We're now ending with that as a beat again. And then when... Yeah, that's the plot.
That'll do. That's enough.
Fuck this.
Oh,
that's
my God.
Enough.
Well done.
So issues to discuss. If you don't mind, I've got...
I mean,
normally we do stuff that we like, but this was a fucking slog and a waste of...
I have nothing I like in this movie. I really...
It's so pointless. We didn't need this at all.
I don't like its intention. No. I don't like its execution.
I don't like its palette. I don't like its
there's
tone.
There's no one in it I enjoy.
There's a warbling ballad over the credits with, like... footage of the space whales being space whales and being ethereal, and there's a bit where one of them like breaches like a humpback into the sunset, and I went, fuck me, orange, everything had been blue relentlessly for like, it's the first time I saw like red and yellow colours
off the Free Willy shot.
But I was like, oh wow, a different colour.
if you're younger than a millennial, Free Willy was a movie from the 90s.
Yeah, it was
about
not an
a whale
opera that was on or anything.
There's a very iconic shot of this orca leaping in the sky over the top of a boy.
Yeah.
It's
hard to explain like past kids. But, you know, yeah, we used to have Free Willy and Muffin the Mule, and these were all completely innocent things that we were all doing.
I mean, I do have an itemized list of why I think this doesn't work. But if you want to, what are your bullet points and things you want to discuss?
So, I was going to do this, like you say, as a back to basics thing, as things we need to talk about. So let's talk about what doesn't work, and then I'll get to mine. So what do you got?
Okay, all right. Well, I want to actually frame the debate, I can. So I think that it is very, very important as a script doctor, dramaturgical person, which is something that I'm doing increasingly more of, giving notes, is that it's really, really fundamental to me that when you're critiquing something, you are critiquing it in good faith based on what it's trying to do, not your own personal taste, unless you're a reviewer, in which case you get to say whatever you like.
Yeah.
And I just want to digress very slightly with the example of Saltburn, which
right.
you haven't seen.
No.
But... Saltburn is recently come out. It is the second movie from Emerald Fennell, who made Promising Young Woman. I think it is a really stunning and incredibly bold piece of filmmaking that I really, really enjoyed and haven't been able to stop thinking about. And it's been incredibly divisive. And part of what has divided people is that lots and lots of people have said, this is such a weak satire.
Mm.
But what's really interesting is, if you watch any interview with Emerald Fennell, for even 10 seconds, she never intended to make a satire
at all.
And so it's got this weight of all these other people's expectations, quite possibly because Promising Young Woman was quite political.
Yeah.
And because this is about a kind of feckless aristocratic family, they think it's going to be a satire. And she never set out to make one.
Yeah, fair.
So she's getting all this criticism for stuff that she didn't mean to do. So what I'm trying to do with this is to, like, take his... What is James Cameron trying to do?
Yeah.
And I have actually, like, looked up interviews with him.
Yeah, you went down that road, and God bless you
for
it.
You've
taken that bullet.
What he's trying to do. Now, the fact it is the same again, I was thinking about this. Often that is what sequels are, right? So a really, really good sequel, I think, should either be because the end of the movie that you just watched... springboarded into a really interesting proposition that you then want to watch the next iteration of this franchise.
Yeah.
But a huge amount of sequels are just basically the same movie that we all enjoyed.
Yeah.
And we just wanted to spend more time there, and then it's more or less the same again.
Yeah, I mean, and some of them, like, justifiably so. I mean, things like, you know, James Bond is going to go on another mission. Batman is going to be fighting crimes. Another arch criminal will crop up. So all this makes sense that you can just keep doing this ad nauseum.
Exactly. Yeah. So whilst I didn't enjoy the fact that it was enormously repetitive, you know, in terms of repeating Avatar 1, although it is repetitive in and of itself as well, I think that that is not a great criticism of the movie. The problem is that it's repeating a movie I fucking hated the first time round.
Yeah, it's not doing anything new or different, or it's not an interesting twist on it. It pretty much is the same film. And one of my issues to discuss with Stakes is that nobody's staying dead. It's even the same bad guys who we killed once already.
Yeah.
You know, and Sigourney Weaver's dead, but is in this again, like, both in a coma and also as another version of herself.
Yes.
And like you say, we have the same blow-by-blow of, like, oh, you have to learn to ride some sort of dragon in the first one, Loch Ness monster. Like, it's just the same.
I think your point of Stakes is really right, and that was actually one of my bullet points. Was Avatar and the idea of peril. So I think that there's a couple of problems. One is that because we have, like, originally he was an avatar, right? That was the whole point of why it's called Avatar, is because Jake was a marine who was going to be, like, piloting this cat person.
Yeah.
And I can't remember the rules. If the cat person died, did Jake die back in...
Yes, initially. And I think the end of the first one, they did some sort of magic ceremony to
make him
meld
be in
his
that
brain
body.
And he is now just that cat monster.
But because it's got this CGI digital weightless quality, and because so much of it looks like a video game, but because it's narratively sort of so badly structured that you have these long sequences, I kept saying, like, oh, this is another cutscene here.
Yeah.
Because it looks like someone playing a video game all the time.
There was, because of the algorithms, an ad for Avatar the New Game in something else we were watching just after we watched it. And I said, yeah, I bet this is way more fun as a game than it is to just sit and watch.
To, like, fly around on like a talking whale or whatever.
Yeah.
But because it looks so much like that, it gives it this very weightless quality where it's very hard to be worried about them dying.
Yeah.
Now, in a good thing, that isn't a problem. So, like, in Toy Story, if, you know, one of the toys, if Buzz is going to get, like, obliterated by a lawnmower, your heart would be like, oh, no, God, my God. But it doesn't help, I think, because these characters are so badly written, you already don't care about them. But the weightless kind of CGI quality makes it harder to take it seriously, particularly when there are live actors in it as well.
It's interesting that we're sort of pinging off each other's notes, because one of mine is, like, making people care. It's like Pixar can break your heart, but, you know, which is all CGI and all should be as weightless, but it's not, right? Because you actually care about these characters. Whereas, like you say, these are just cartoon blue cat monsters, and I mean the word cartoon, the CGI. No, I mean cartoon. They are sort of cartoonishly written, and also that they are digital.
See, this is how much we've spent time together, because this was my other point. Yeah, they are completely like stock characters.
Yeah.
They are so boring.
Yeah.
They've got nothing to them, and they've got, like, barely any defining characteristics at all.
Yeah.
And it makes it really, really hard to hold on to. So, sorry, we're bouncing around all over the place. It's actually really difficult to take apart a film which is so badly made in so many different fronts, because these all build into each other. So I'm going to go back from the top, if
and
work down. Okay, one, the biggest problem with this movie is that it is thunderingly boring.
Yeah.
Why is it so boring? One, was that we talked about, it's extremely repetitive.
Yeah, extremely repetitive. It's extremely repetitive.
Both of the original film, but also within itself. And the key, one of the things that is a good example of this is the swimming scenes, right?
Yeah.
So they arrive at this new, they're not water cat people, they're tree cat people, they don't know how to swim. So the young ones have to learn how to swim. So there's a whole sequence where they get taken under the water and they learn how to swim.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's another sequence where they get a special thing on their back that means that they can breathe underwater. So they just spent ages learning a breathing technique. Then we sack that off and go, well, actually, there's this, like, magic clam thing you can put on you.
It's
that
like
will
a
just
weird jellyfish parasite that you can borrow for a bit.
Yeah, like scuba diving. So then we have an entire sequence of them doing that.
Yeah.
And then there's an entire other sequence where they learn, I think about 3 or 4 times we have a montage of them learning to swim, by which point I'm incredibly bored, but I also don't, it undermines the stakes because I don't understand it. Because in the big action finale battle at the end, which takes place in water, there's all this stuff about people drowning. And I was genuinely like, can they drown? Some of them can drown, but there's a special breathing technique. But if you have a jellyfish, but then sometimes some of them can drown, but some of them can't drown.
It's like playing action figures with a 7-year-old, right? Oh no, because now I've got a magic jump, now I've got this, and now this happens, and now I can do that. And it's like, oh, now I'm bulletproof. And it's like, what are we doing here?
Yeah.
What's the Jason.
So it is treading water, literally. Ironically.
Avatar 2, Treading Water is a better title.
It really is. Yeah. All the way through. But then it also undermines the peril later on because it makes the rules of the world unclear, right? So there's that. And then there are too many characters and all of them are boring.
Yeah.
So you can kind of differentiate, and also because we don't actually have the actors. So if I was like, oh, look, well, that one's Kate Winslet, I know that one, and this one's Sigourney Weaver and whatever, then you can kind of keep track of more people. But because they are identikit blue people,
it's really hard. And this is one of the things I was going to say about fixes. Well, we'll get to it, I guess.
Can we do fixes in a minute? So interestingly, so I looked up, and because we're introducing so many characters, not only are they difficult to keep hold of, but like it's just more people that you don't care about. And he, in an interview in Variety, James Cameron said, "It's dangerous." This is a quote. "It's dangerous to tell a story with a lot of characters because it can lack focus."
Uh-huh.
So he 100% knows the pitfalls of this. "I was trying to emulate a Star Wars universe or Lord of the Rings where you can have multiple stories." But the key thing that he has misunderstood about that is that it's really easy to keep track of who everyone is in Star Wars.
Yeah, one of them's a cowboy, one of them's a wizard, one of them's a giant fucking ape monster.
Yes! So, one of them's a gold robot, one of them's a fucking yeti.
Yeah, one of them's a farm boy. It's like you're not going to confuse them on screen.
Nobody ever says,
"What do you think, Luke?" I mean Chewbacca, sorry, I always confuse them.
Oh, sorry, was that Yoda or Princess Leia?
Yeah.
Right? Same.
Which
with,
is the sexy one?
And to a slightly
it's
lesser...
It's Yoda.
A lesser extent, Lord of the Rings as well.
Yeah, there's a dwarf and a human and a tree monster
there's
a wizard again.
Some of them are really short. Those ones are the hobbits.
Yeah. Like, the slightly bigger short ones with the axes, those are dwarves, we understand. Right. Yeah.
And so... Yeah. But then also he later goes on in that Variety article to go, so I saw that in Star Wars and in Lord of the Rings, they have these different like worlds that all these different characters come from and that's how they manage it. But I thought, hey, the Na'vi people are based on indigenous people that we have here on Earth.
Right.
And here on Earth, people are really quite similar. So when I'm doing my multi-universe, I'll just make them all quite similar because it's unnecessary to make them different. No, it isn't!
Yeah, no, it's not.
It's really important to make them different.
Yeah. And also, if you had, like, a Cherokee guy and a Kenyan guy and a Scandinavian guy and a Maori guy.
Yeah. Like, yeah, if they were all like in their traditional dress of their people.
Well, again, nobody's even dressed in this movie because they're all at the beach. And aside from the fact that the water cat people are slightly more turquoise and the tree cat people are slightly darker blue and the water's blue and everything's blue forever.
Some of them have got tattoos and stuff, but it is not, if you imagine... listener, in your head, the lineup of characters in Star Wars, or even the lineup of the Lord of the Rings Fellowship, they all just look incredibly different. And like, what is baffling to me is that he's seen that, he's understood that, and then gone, "I don't need it.
No,
my characters are so good that I don't need that." And actually, his characters are so bad.
Yeah.
You just cannot. I think one of the basic things you should be able to do with characters is tell them apart.
Yeah.
And I can't tell you any of them.
As a slight digression, I think, weirdly, and possibly for the first time in recorded history, it's time to give a lot of credit to Arnold Schwarzenegger as an actor. Because when James Cameron made The Terminator, a lot of the physicality of The Terminator was Arnold's idea. And it's little things like, in The Terminator, if you watch, when The Terminator's looking for somebody, he moves his eyes first and then his head like a security camera, which is not how a human being moves their head, right? But he's doing this sort of tracking thing with his eyes and slightly more robotic movements, which is all Arnold's idea.
Is it?
And he differentiates himself from it. Like, The Terminator looks human but isn't, and he's actually doing quite good work making that happen visually, right?
Which
clearly James Cameron can't do, because this is what he's failing at here. It's like, The Terminator is a white male, and so is Michael Biehn's character in that movie, but you understand intrinsically how they are very, very different.
And
right?
For a movie that is almost entirely about the design, right, it's baffling to me that the design is just the same.
Just blue. Just the make same. Everything blue.
But, like, physically, just almost exactly the same.
Yeah.
Like, the differences between the Na'vi people are so slight. Like, they've got, like, slightly different tails.
Yeah.
Yeah, like you say, very slightly different skin colours. And in addition to how visually similar everybody is, like you say, they are real stock characters and they are just completely full of cliches. I mean, the second that Sigourney Weaver's special, like, virgin birth child, and then you just, like, take one look at her face, and she's got a stupid kind of shaggy pixie haircut, and I was like, oh, she's going to be magic.
Yeah,
and at a certain
she has
point,
these strange trances that nobody understands. I wonder if they're going to crop up in 2 hours' time.
Commune
in this
with
shit
God,
show. Yeah.
And at a really special point during the battle, yeah. after being an outcast, her magic powers are going to yeah. kick in, and she's going to actually save the day.
Yeah, but also like and. Aside from the fact that they're stock characters and boring and rote, they're not even consistent, right? Because, mm-hmm. like, Jake Sully's character, who is still calling himself Jake Sully, which is just really jarring to me. Jarheading to me. Figure it out. He's like, he keeps saying, like, the sky people came back again, but we're the Navi now, and they're the sky people. But then he still raises his sons to say, like, yes, sir, and no, sir, because he's a former Marine. So, like, is he still trapped in his Marine mindset as a rigid human military type, or is he now this hippie sky child thing? Like, he's doing both at the same time, and they don't mesh at all.
No, it doesn't. And so, in more skillful hands, if he was really thought through as a character properly, that could come across as an interesting contradiction, right?
Yeah,
so,
if anything, I guess this comes under fixes, but if anything, maybe he has completely renounced the militarism of his past and therefore has not made his kids tough enough, and this is a problem, mm-hmm. right? And he's going to have to learn to actually toughen his children up and, you know, instill that mindset in them.
He's trying to adopt these new fashioned, these new ideals of his new culture,
yeah.
but then when push comes to shove, you know, he loses his temper and he smacks his kid because that's what his dad did to him, and under pressure he's going to default to type,
yeah.
right? That would be an interesting character because that has layers in it, that has a history thought through. But I think that one of the biggest problems with Avatar is it is, and if I go back to what was James Cameron trying to do, he just likes playing in this world and he likes how it looks. His I think if you were to rank his passion for making this, number one is the design and the capability of the technology, which has become less and less and less impressive over time, as everyone could now basically make avatars like this and do shit on your phone, rather than when it was first birthed. Secondly, if he has anything that he wants to say, he has, when we'll get onto it, a sort of baffling, thundering, colonial, strange,
it's sort of oblivious white savior stuff.
Message. So, like, his politics are in that. And I don't think at any point, it's like his character is like way, 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 way down on the list of things that he's interested in.
Yeah, he doesn't really. He's just thrown. Well, this is unobtainium as a MacGuffin all over again, right? It's like it feels like a first pass at this script, and you go, "Oh, we'll come up with something better later." And he just doesn't bother.
And interestingly, like the characters are just avatars for exploring his kind of some of his political ideas, rather than like, "Oh, let's like look at the psychology properly of Jake Sully." And he's probably the most rounded character out of all of them. So like you say, these things of like, there's this whole montage of his kids like in the forest, like homeschooling, and it's so holistic. And he's like even narrating, because it, just in case it's not on the nose enough, there's a voiceover telling you about how much better it is to be back to nature. And like, oh, we just like exist with the trees and the forest and each other. And it's like loads better than when I was a human. And we just learned all this stuff on my gap year. But then, like you say, 10 minutes later, his kids are calling him sir and yes sir and no sir. And it's just like, that's the exact opposite of what you were just doing. Point number six, I think, and the final point really is just this movie takes itself so seriously. If for a movie about blue cat people in space, it is so po-faced and so grandiose. It's so pompous.
I don't think there's a single joke in it, and I think in this film and in the previous one, keep forgetting the guy's name, Stephen Lang. I always forget Stephen Lang's name. Probably my favourite thing in it as the bad guy is Colonel Quaritch, because he, in the first one and this one, seems to be the only person having any fucking fun with it. You know? And he is sort of slightly growly badass chewing the scenery performance, but at least he's doing something, you know?
This movie is no fun. It is no fun. So, like, I am really happy to, and this sort of ties back to stock characters. I don't even mind stock characters that much and cliches if they are being done in this joyful way, if they are just a romp and you were just doing something. One of my favourite movies of all time is Romy and Michelle's High School Reunion. It's one of the stupidest films ever made, and I absolutely adore it because it is so fun. It is such a good, fun movie. And crucially, I really, really care about Romy and Michelle, even though the stakes are them going to their high school reunion, not like the fate of an entire planet.
And in terms of stupidity that we disagree on, I thoroughly enjoy Three Amigos.
Yes, you do. Fair enough. So this criticism isn't coming from the fact that we need all films to be, he's not trying, you know, And not everything has to be Citizen Kane.
Yeah, yeah.
But he's not even trying to make Citizen Kane. It's like, I mean, how to unpick James Cameron's views on this. So, in the...
Are we doing fixes? Are we going
to
try and
I think it's just important to kind of talk about the weird racial colonial shit that's in this movie.
My ending note is that Sigourney Weaver's Messiah Baby is once again white savioring the fuck out of this franchise, right?
Yeah.
So for those not familiar, there's this whole white savior thing, and it's a whole trope that, like, for example, Tarzan is the classic example, right? So Tarzan is an aristocratic English baby who was abandoned in the jungle in Africa and becomes better at living in the jungle than all the people that have lived in Africa for thousands of years, right?
Isn't it Last of the Mohicans?
Last of the Mohicans, yeah. A white guy turns out to be better at being a Native American than all the actual Native American people, because white people are inherently better. That's the message,
yep.
You know? And then in the first Avatar movie, Jake Sully becomes a blue cat person and becomes the chief blue cat person because he's so good at being a blue cat person, even though he wasn't one by birth.
But he's generous enough to save everybody.
Yes, and then in this one, Sigourney Weaver, the white lady who's become a blue cat person, has had a magic messiah baby who's going to control nature and be our bridge to God.
Yeah.
So once again,
now
it's really fucking uncomfortable, everybody.
It's really, really weird. Now, there is a lot of thundering stuff in this movie, and I say it because it's like literally just said in voiceover over and over again that, number one, Na'vi people are better because they are more kind of basic. They're more like
they're more pure and in tune with
pure, more childlike almost. These are all horrible racist colonial cliches that were made by white people as justification for taking over other lands and enslaving other people by saying that they were primitive, that they were more stupid, that they were naive, that they were childlike and they need to be taken care of. Yeah. You don't have to go back very far at all to find any of these cliches everywhere. James Cameron seems to think that these are all like good qualities. So like, it can't be racist if I'm saying that it's nice that they're all spiritually naive and sweet.
He sort of almost comes near understanding it in the first film of like, what if we treat native cultures like fully fledged sentient beings? Like, yeah, that's a good idea, James Cameron. Well done. You've made the first step along this train of thought and gone no further.
Yeah.
And this one seems to kind of forget that, and also the message of this one is just like, whaling is bad, you guys. It's like the most basic fucking sick form bullshit that he's...
I mean, it is a bit galling. In interviews, again, he talks a lot, and again, he talks about it in the movies, about like the native, the indigenous peoples are, you know, the keepers of nature, and therefore, I mean, again, these are all big, broad, sweeping comments without actual basis in, you know, research or anything, or maybe even speaking to some indigenous cultures, although that, you know, respect for nature is an important part of some of them, but I don't think,
Again, it's a complex
issue. It's a complex issue because you're talking about millions of people across the world.
People are not monoliths.
That exist in different cultures. But he's saying, oh, basically it's an environmental message, right?
Yeah.
Like, oh, this we need to like learn from these people to like take care of the earth. But you're making billions of dollars doing this rather than like actually ploughing money. This Avatar costs like $2 billion, Avatar 2.
What was the carbon footprint of this movie? I would be intrigued to know.
Exactly.
You've flown everybody to New Zealand, I think.
You spent hours and hours and hours making Kate Winslet breathe underwater so that you could CGI an avatar of her breathing underwater.
Yeah.
Like the amount of fucking, I'm sure the carbon footprint of these is just galactic.
Yeah.
It is so patronizing. So, and he's got this whole horrible white savior thing. He's just doing it again completely in this movie. I think the characterization of a lot of the Na'vi people is incredibly patronizing, if not completely outright offensive, particularly when they're played by white actors.
Yeah.
Kate Winslet.
Yes.
Spends a lot of time.
And also whichever one of the sons it was thinks he
like,
has. Yeah.
Wearing a loincloth and squatting and grunting and being feral.
Yes, she's very feral in this.
She's very feral in this. Do you want to know his plans for the next ones?
Oh, God. I mean, but it's a little bit like having the monster in Alien. Like, I don't want it on the ship. I would prefer to know where it is at all times if it has to be here. So with that mentality in mind, what's he gonna do next?
Okay, so Avatar 3 is already in the can.
Oh, sorry, I thought you can like toilet.
4 and 5 are both written already.
Good, good.
And they've already got some of 4. So in case you were thinking Avatar 2 is a completely needless sequel, don't worry. We've already got 3, 4, and 5. So that's potentially 3, 6, 9, around 9 to 10 more hours of this franchise, which is going to be, if they each cost $2 billion, another $6 billion dollars to make.
I really feel, sorry, just to digress for a second, but I really feel like with hindsight,
The first Avatar film, James Cameron was really the canary in the coal mine for how billionaires are now behaving. Like, he was the first guy to go, I've got infinite money, I'm going to do whatever the fuck I want. And we should have called it there and gone, this is going to be a problem. Because it's a short hop from, I'm going to make everybody watch my weird blue cat wank fantasy. It's a short hop to, like, I'm going to buy Twitter and everyone has to live in my metaverse and have no legs. And all this shit that, like, rich white men just do. Like, yeah, everyone has to do things my way now because I've got all the money. And I think the first inclination of that was probably Avatar being
That's true. And yes, if we also haven't discussed the disturbing sexuality of Avatar, because I think we left that in Avatar 1.
Yeah.
But yeah, Avatar 2, I mean, they don't really wear clothes. They kind of plug in like their hair. They've got like plaits with tentacles.
They do like hair sex.
Plug into animals.
In this one, Bailey Bass, who we mentioned in our interview with the vampire episode, she's very good in that. She plays the overtly sexy cat teenage water girl who like comes out of the sea in a sort of Ursula undress shot. Like she's a water cat girl in a bikini.
Sexy teen cat girl. It just, and the over sexualization of indigenous women is like, that's a whole other racist trope as well that we're just going to fling in there.
I'm going to say, let's do what James Cameron can't and just draw a veil around the sex thing. I don't think we have the time or the inclination to unpick it.
Anyway. Okay, so if you thought the sort of racial politics of Avatar 1 and 2 were kind of uncomfortable, distasteful, maybe even just full-on racist.
At best, ill thought out and patronising,
In Avatar 3.
Yeah.
Okay, so we had Avatar 1, Tree People.
Yeah.
Avatar 2, The Way of Water.
Yeah.
The way the franchise is going is based on the elements.
Oh, God.
So Avatar 3 is about fire, and we have the Ash People. And the thing is, and a quote again from James Cameron. So far, we've only shown Na'vi people in a very positive light and humans in a very negative light. Right. So in Avatar 3, we'll have the exact opposite.
Oh.
So in Avatar 3, the indigenous people are the baddies and the colonizers are going to be the goodies.
I feel like we're getting into this territory, and I'm going to predict this now. Having just learned that from you, and I'm just calling this one in the air, he's going to try and do space western, isn't he? He's going to do like an arid desert with the fire people, where you're going to have a human outpost like Fort Apache, where they're being picked off by these savages. That I think that's the way we're going to go with this.
Considering that it's every idea within these franchises is insanely derivative,
Yeah, that's my... Do we know what 4 and 5 are doing yet, or has he announced that 3 is going to be...
If we've had...
A new flavour of racism.
If Avatar 1 doesn't count as Earth, which I guess it does, if we've got fire and water, then we've only got air and earth left.
Yeah. And heart, if you're Captain Planet.
I mean, there aren't five elements,
Well, I mean, it depends. Are you doing a whole periodic table? Are you going to get 120 of these? But is one of them unobtainium? More questions than answers.
We don't care about unobtainium. We also don't care about the fountain of youth that exists inside whales' heads.
I'm getting to that.
All right, go on. Okay, so we try and fucking fix this?
Okay, so let's go back to basics. So, how to differentiate characters. We need to talk about this, right? Yep. We touched on this already, but like James Cameron saying it's a danger to do too many characters. Well, I think we've said on the show before, audiences, as a rule of thumb, can remember about 7 characters, right?
Yeah, now I've heard that this is apocryphal, but I think it's sort of anecdotally about right.
It seems about right. It's one of those, it's probably not a hard rule, but it seems like a good way to work.
I mean, the 7 dwarfs, but then you also have Snow White and the Evil Queen.
Yeah,
so.
But you have 7 dwarves, you have 7 samurai, which become the Magnificent 7. There's often, like, when you get a big cast, you get about 7.
Yeah, I think you don't want to be, you've got to be careful once you start, if you get above 10, it starts getting really difficult.
Yeah. And again, we touched on this already, but that's what I was going to say, is that if you're going to have a huge cast, the 7 dwarves are easy. They're literally grumpy, sleepy, happy, right? They've put the labels right on them, you can tell. And within the Magnificent 7 and the 7 Samurai, they all use different weapons and different techniques, so you can recognise who's doing what.
I think Star Wars is a really good... Yeah, sorry, yeah. It's like quality.
And that's what I was going to say, is that when you get something like Game of Thrones, which has a huge cast, they're very, very clear, about signposting where you are geographically and with set dressing and with costumes, right?
Yes.
Which, like you say, James Cameron is not doing. So like, all right, there's a big cast in Game of Thrones, but you know when you're in the sort of Dothraki waste because it's a desert compared to the north, which is cold and looks a bit like Ireland, funnily enough. And then you sort of get King's Landing, which was Malta, and then Dubrovnik, where it's sort of Mediterranean. So just by filming there, you can see this, like the way the light hits, the way the buildings, it's very obvious where you are and which cast you're dealing with. Right?
Yes, absolutely. And also within that, because you've got the geographical place that is different, different. Yeah. And then accordingly, there is a colour palette that is different that you just touched upon. That also goes because they're in different places and they have different climates. They're wearing different things.
Yeah.
So, you know, the guys on the wall are all in these huge furs.
Yeah, mantles, it's
because
cold.
It's freezing, right? Yeah. Whereas, like, you know, when they're in King's Landing, they're all in these very light kind of clothes. So you have costume that helps differentiate. Yeah. And you have kind of have fashions as well, which help differentiate. You also have a consistency of accent and kind of type of voice. So like all of the Northerners all speak with like Yorkshire accents, essentially.
Although apparently this was down to Sean Bean, because all the actors that were playing as kids thought all have to sound like Sean Bean, so they're all sort of doing this Sheffield Sean Bean, but it works.
But it helps. Yeah. It helps. Whereas like in Avatar, by comparison, there is
people in the same family have vastly different geographic accents.
People in the same family have got completely different accents, so that's not helping tie you to anywhere. They all basically look identical, and also the worlds all look identical. It is just blue, like you said, that burst of orange is so different. But like when you're traveling around Game of Thrones, you know, when you think of King's Landing, all these orange, warm, golden tones.
Yeah, stucco, and it's buildings that are built
in the Mediterranean. Yeah, yeah. Like, it all looks completely different. And again, Star Wars, everything looks different. Yeah. All the characters look completely different. It sounds basic, but it's incredibly important.
Well, this is the thing, because like it's often a criticism of hacky work, is that like letting the costume do the acting for somebody, but it really does help.
Mm.
And like people always say about Star Wars, like, oh, I'm from a forest planet, and like, look at Earth. We've got forests. We've got all kinds of different terrains. It's not just a forest planet. But for the sake of simplicity and as a shorthand, it's much more useful than not having anything, which is what we got here. So we're just unmoored at all times.
Yes, I think unmoored is exactly the way to do it.
And you mentioned this before. When we watched The Thing, and you were saying that like Kurt Russell's character has a sombrero that he uses for his outdoor hat. And you said that's a really good character beat, because it's like, okay, so this guy is well-travelled and slightly maverick. And you can tell that just from the hat that he's got with him, if you look at it.
Yeah, and he doesn't give a shit what everyone else thinks.
And we've got, I mentioned that, again, in Game of Thrones, Bronn, the mercenary, has a kukri knife, which is a very distinctive shape of blade and slightly weird one. But it implies, again, where did he get that from? This guy's got a bit of a backstory, because he's got this weird dagger that nobody else has seen carrying. Like, so he's got that from somewhere farther afield.
Yeah.
It tells you, again, about the backstory of the character without having to do anything.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I think, like, when I was... So I did the BBC Writers Academy, and one of the things that they talked about on that was... an iconic character you could draw as a cartoon.
Yes.
You could distill them down into a couple of essences and you could probably recognise them from their silhouette or, you know, if they're a human, like from a couple of traits.
Yeah.
So if you think of a character like Del Boy or Pat Butcher or, you know, any really iconic character, Hercule Poirot, right?
This is Indiana Jones's hat, right?
They're really distinctive but they also, and with that comes an entire kind of attitude and a voice, and you would be able to predict how they behave because they're just paper thin. They're not even paper thin, they're digitally thin characters.
Literally don't exist.
You just really feel like there's been no thought really put into them about what the differences of their personalities are. Yeah. Interestingly, James Cameron said the two teenage sons are based on his teenage sons.
Oh, God.
And his teenage son said, "You don't know us at all."
Wow.
And he thought that was really funny.
Huh. I mean, George Foreman, the boxer, famously had five sons and he named them all George, right? But I feel like James Cameron's sons are James Jr. and James Jr. Dad, we already had a James Jr. Quiet, James Jr.
It's interesting because I would have said, far from being based on real people who are your actual children, they feel like they've been written by someone who's never met a teenage boy and has only heard of them from films.
Well, yeah, I mean, ask the nanny, I don't know. He's never dealt with them. He was underwater at the time. And again, to go back to the first film, Stephen Lang's character, Colonel Quaritch, when he's human, has like horrific scars across one side of his face, which you're introduced in his opening monologue, where he talks about how dangerous Pandora is. And you go, okay, first of all, that tells you something about the character, that it is dangerous out there. He's been out there and has been hurt badly before and is still, you know, he's badass enough that he's come back for more.
Mm-hmm.
And also, like, it gives that character a visual cue. Again, just give one of the sons a tattoo, a fucking stripe, a scar, anything, so I can tell which one I'm looking at.
Yeah, and I think that ultimately, you know... character really is everything, and you can make something look incredible and you can, you know, throw money at it, you can cast the starriest people in the world, but ultimately all you're watching, if you don't care about the characters, then all you're watching is a very glossy, like, screensaver.
Yeah.
Like, there's only so long you can hold anyone's attention to watch anything without you being invested in the characters and being interested, or if you're not deeply invested in the characters, you really, really want to know what's going to happen. Yeah. So like a murder mystery or a thriller or something, you want to know who killed the person, yeah, or like what the secret is of the thing. And that's driving you to solve the thing. But on this, we have no strong engine of what do we care about? What are we rooting for? Why do we care? We just kind of, the plot feels like it just stumbles around a lot.
Well, the only one who actually has a motivation, again, is the bad guy who is going to hunt whales to try and draw Sully out, so that he's got something that he wants and is working towards it through a series of actions.
But this is part of the other thing. It also doesn't make any fucking sense. Yeah. So I don't believe for a second they have deployed, they've basically started a war, a huge war. They have transformed all the human marines into avatars. Yeah. Just for the purposes of catching Jake Sully. Really?
He's like a... because he hasn't done anything for 15 years.
Done anything. He's just been dicking around in the woods.
Living quietly in Fern Gully, narrating his gap year. Yeah. It just occurred to me, like, another thing, we talked about how, like, Pixar is all CGI, but you care about it. But again, if you look at Pixar, Toy Story, they all look radically different. Like, one's a cowboy, one's a spaceman, one's a fucking pig bank, you know? Like,
but they also all have really different personalities. So if you were just given the script of Toy Story and you had all of the names covered up and you were watching a scene...
Yeah, you all talk about this. This is an exercise to do in writing, is can you tell who's talking without knowing who's talking? Yeah.
There's no way that you would read Buzz Lightyear's dialogue and think it was Woody speaking or think it was Mr. Potato Head.
Yeah, yeah.
They've all got completely different voices because they've got different personalities.
Yeah. Okay. Any more fixes?
Many.
Keep people dead. This was the thing. Like, much as I enjoy Stephen Lang in this, we killed him at the end of the first film. He kills him at the end of this film. He survives both times. Like, he's because.
Yeah, exactly. And a term that you'll hear thrown around a lot when we're discussing scripts or, you know, script doctoring story stuff is stakes. What is at stake, or jeopardy or peril? Yeah. These terms get used all the time. And like you say, this just undermines it because it's the same with the breathing thing, making that really complicated. Yeah. It just means that it becomes confusing. Yeah. Like, if people aren't dead, then does it matter if they get killed?
They'll just come back again.
Except
for the elder son who is killed at the end of this movie in a big dramatic beat, but also I couldn't tell which one he was. So it's like, the only one who stays dead is the one that I couldn't pick out of a lineup.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, so I mean, I think that you need, it needs a better story. I think this is a difficult, if you had to tell this story of this guy is going after Jake Sully, which I just really, really don't believe.
Yeah.
Well, the only way to really make me believe that is going to happen is that Jake has to be a really active threat that is happening. And then also, it feels very hollow that he's like, oh my God, like, it's not safe, they're after me, so I have to go somewhere else to protect everybody. But he just goes somewhere else and makes it dangerous there.
Yeah, which is not responsible behaviour.
You're like, oh, I just care about the Na'vi so much. You don't care about the fucking sea ones, do you?
Yeah, yeah.
You just endangered all of them.
They could have gone and lived somewhere on their own separately.
Yes.
On an island or up a mountain or something.
If he's that much of a saviour, he has to go out and battle by himself in order to stop them. Like.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't buy the plot apart from anything else.
Do you have minor fixes? Because I have an overarching attempt at a rewrite here.
Oh God, I'd love to hear it.
Yeah.
No, I don't, because it's such a term I learned recently. Page one rewrite means just start again.
Yes. Yeah. It's. I was thinking about $1 Million Baby. There's that line in Clint Eastwood's voiceover.
God, I'm still upset about that.
Yeah, and that was one of those, along with Requiem for a Dream, one of those films where people are like, oh, it's brilliant, I'm never watching it again. but there's a line in that, based on a book by FX Tool, which was the pen name of a guy called Jerry Boyd, who was a cut man in boxing. Anyway, there's a line in Clint Eastwood's voiceover in $1 Million Baby where he talks about how, like, if you want to train a fighter, you've got to strip them down to the bare wood and start again. But, like, you've got to be careful not to break them, basically. You've got to take them down to the absolute basics and start over, but it's a delicate process a little bit. And that's what I was thinking about this. Like, a page one rewrite is a good term for it, you're right. Because it's like, you've got to strip so much out of this and try and keep it cohesive.
It's so bloated, it is so self-indulgent, and it's got nothing to say, and the things that it does have to say are just big cliches that I don't think I agree with.
Whaling is bad, you guys, and it'd be better if we were all Native Americans.
A man's value is to protect his family.
Yeah, that keeps coming up as well.
Over and over again, so it's got this gender essentialism of it. Are you like, really? All men? All families?
Yeah.
Like, just a big sweeping statement.
We need to live like harmoniously in a tribal culture where everyone's equal, except that it's a man's job to protect his family. Like, James Cameron doesn't know what he thinks. He has not thought through his own philosophy
past. No, he's not thought it.
Like I say, it's a fucking sixth form bullshit.
Well, he's got like six movies to write.
Well, yeah. Yeah, but he's not putting any effort into that. I mean, like, he's got time. Anyway, My attempt at like trying to fix this.
Oh, God, go on.
So I said, make this about age and put Sully and his family way in the background. Mm-hmm. Right? So this is a story about an increasingly senescent human race trying to cling on. And if they have to kill some space whales to do it, then so be it. Then becomes a metaphor for boomers like mm-hmm. James Cameron and also Western society as a whole and imperialism again. Like, make Sully a sort of seldom seen mythical rebel leader like Che Guevara. Like, mm-hmm. he only appears in some scenes. Like, he pops out of the woods, causes chaos, and then vanishes again, because that makes him as dangerous as they say that he is.
Yeah.
Like, he is still leading this war tribe against the human invaders. Yep. And he is... what are we willing to do to save ourselves? That mm-hmm. is the question that humanity has to ask in the present day with climate change. And that is, you know, like, there's a whale, and if we kill it, we can all live forever. What is that worth to us? Is it worth committing these sort of mortal sins? Make this about the whalers, mm-hmm. basically, or make this about the humans that are... it doesn't have to be a whale. Make it. There's another type of tree that if we saw it down and extract it, you know, although the whales are good because they are sentient, and that mm-hmm. is like, are we willing to kill somebody else to save ourselves? The very basic...
Yeah.
And I get that, like, as a plot, that is essentially Moby Dick.
Mm.
But given that they're ripping off everything else, I mean, like, fine, yeah, fuck it, we'll do, you know. And there's a short story by Ursula K. Le Guin called The Ones That Walk Away from Omelas, which is very similar to, and she acknowledges, very similar to a conversation that is had in The Brothers Karamazov about basically there's a perfect society where everyone is happy and everything works perfectly and everything's fine. But in order for it to run through magical reasons, it runs on the fact that we have to keep a young child who hasn't done anything wrong and torture them indefinitely.
Mm-hmm.
But that is the magical method by which society runs and everyone else is happy. Do we do it?
Mm-hmm.
And in The Brothers Karamazov, one of them says, well, I would want no part of such a society.
Mm-hmm.
And the point of Omelas, which is a very short story, is she says that like everyone's happy there, but some people leave.
Mm-hmm.
And so they seem to know where they're going, the ones that walk away from Omelas. The point, like, can you stand to be part of this?
Mm-hmm.
That's the question that you're asking there. That's how you do it. So there are space whales that can prevent, maybe have a lead character. Again, have a human lead character for a start, because it's so much fucking easier to identify with, and we get it. But maybe have, like, an aging human character whose wife has early onset dementia or something. Like, you can stop this, but you have to kill something that is innocent and sentient mm-hmm. to do it. Is it worth doing it? And can we do this on a grand scale? What is it worth to save ourselves?
Right? Yeah.
There you go. That's a plot.
But that is already 100 times more compelling, because it's a really, really interesting central question that is alive, that requires like nuance and thought that you can attack from different regions. And tied into that, not only have you got a really interesting central sort of premise to start from as like a little kernel to grow out of, you've also then tied that into character motivation, right? So then we've got something that's at stake, we've got characters, we've got coherence. And it just completely exposes that in Avatar, despite however much he might wang on in interviews that he cares about the environment and that he thinks indigenous people are really special and stuff, there's no real drive or coherence, because Avatar 2 isn't about saving the environment.
No.
And it isn't really about anything.
Maybe.
Really. It's so vague and waffly.
Yeah. Maybe, this just occurred to me, maybe in order to like extract resources of any kind, sentient or otherwise, from Pandora, you have to launch like pirate raids onto Pandora, because the Na'vi are keeping humans out through Jake Sully. He's actually such a great war chieftain that humans don't dare go there anymore. So you have to be effectively space pirates that are going to come down, try to get onto the planet and get away clean with this magic stuff. Then you've got an element of danger. It builds Jake Sully up. Like I say, keep him way in the background. He's mm-hmm. only in a few mm-hmm. scenes of this. He's just a sort of like the Viet Cong or like any guerrilla force, right?
Yeah,
like you don't
know
where they are, but they know the terrain better than you and you're on their patch. That makes him extremely dangerous and very scary.
I think the thing is, if you're going to have, right, so either you have, like, the first thing you discussed, which is we've got this character and they seem to be doing a bad thing, right, killing the whales, but they're doing it for this reason, like, because they love their wife, right?
Yeah.
So you've got this complexity then of the question, which is compelling, right? Or if you're going to make it, what... when you hear James Cameron talk, basically, roughly what he's saying is... environment good, people destroying environment bad.
Yeah.
That's not a compelling central premise for a movie, right?
No.
Because that feels like you're not going to find anybody, if you canvass them, going, hey, do you think we should fuck over the environment more? Is that good?
How many pandas do you think we should burn?
It's yeah.
like, well, none. We're all going to say none.
Yes. I'm going to set this tree on fire just for funsies.
Yeah.
What do you reckon?
Yeah, I'm against it.
Yeah, exactly. There's no nuance in that argument. There's nothing. And then if you're going to have a kind of moralistic stance or theme or message in your movie that is very black and white, that you're not really going to find anyone
or blue and a different shade of blue,
then you need to have incredibly compelling characters.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you have a movie where someone's, you know, wife and child have been taken and they have to get them back, well, that's a very black and white moral situation, yeah, yeah. right? Well, then you have to really care about that character. You have to be interested in how they're going to do that thing. So we just don't, again, we don't have any of it.
Yeah.
I'm not watching Avatar 3. I've already said I wasn't going to watch Avatar 2. Avatar 3 is scheduled to come out December 20, 2024.
Oh, so we've got another year.
Yes, we've got another year. So we could be back here this time next year talking about Avatar 3, and I won't do it!
No, I think we've done very well to do Avatar 2, Treading Water. I think that's enough, unless we get a writing campaign, which given that we never get anybody writing in except Dean Cain's representatives, I think we're gonna plant a flag here and just say, no more Avatar.
He's just got nothing to say, and he's taking so long to say it.
Also, Avatar 2, Avatarder was right there, and he didn't do it. If you would like to start a writing campaign, we are available, artholepodcast@gmail.com. You can send us emails. We are not on Twitter anymore. Nobody is, except the racists and Elon Musk.
Exactly.
Screaming into a void of his own creation.
I mean, I am on a fascist social media platform, as they all are. Yeah. I'm on Instagram.
Yeah.
At ScriptTits.
I'm on Blue Sky, but I don't think anybody else is. So if you're the other guy on Blue Sky, say hello.
But we will be doing some Christmas movies soon. We are contemplating, potentially, we've been dancing around this one for ages, is Love Actually.
Ugh.
But what I, because, you know, maybe we could rewrite it. Maybe we could fix Love Actually.
I think we threaten this every year.
We do threaten this every year. It's becoming a tradition. But if you'd actually like to see us do it, let us know. We'd love to hear from you. And just the other thing, if you want to support the podcast in any way, if you want to say thank you for watching Avatar 2, so we don't have to, then you can buy us a coffee. It's just a way of just giving us a couple of quid without any kind of monthly subscription or anything like that. We will put a link in the description. I realised last week I didn't actually explain what it was because I was too busy making a dick joke, so this week I thought I'd actually explain it.
It was ever thus. All right, until next time.
Bye.
Next year on Pandora.
No.